This is CD 14 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a four-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains session number 12 titled Social Aspects.
Now, we're going to be talking today about the social aspects of sadhana, and I'm just going to read to you three or four shlokas from the Gita. He has risen on the heights of his soul, and in peace he beholds relatives, companions, and friends, those impartial or indifferent, or who hate him. He sees them all with the same inner peace. Who everywhere is free from all ties, who neither rejoices nor sorrows if fortune is good or is ill, his is a serene wisdom. With the same evenness of love, they behold a Brahmin who is learned and holy, or a cow, or an elephant, or a dog, or even a man who eats a dog. With the same evenness of love. The man whose love is the same for his enemies or his friends, whose soul is the same in honor or disgrace, who is balanced in blame and praise, whose home is not in this world, and who has love, this man is dear to me. Most of us have grown up with a preoccupation with individual differences because it's been very efficient, but it's also been very neurotic, so that we get very discriminating about individual differences, and we call that being sophisticated. And with our own individual differences, we get totally preoccupied. We come through childhood, most of us, there are exceptions in this room, but few of them. We come through childhood with some sense of inferiority, inadequacy, impotence, incompetence, and that's kind of emotional, non-conceptual. It's just a feeling that comes from early child rearing. And we don't have to go into the dynamics of how that develops, but it just is a common thing. It almost is so pervasive that it looks almost like the feelings that come out of a sense of original sin, if you want to do it from a religious point of view. But then what we do is we start to identify our individual differences with these feelings of inadequacy, or badness, or wrongness, or feelings we've got to do good in order to be okay. Not that we start out by being okay, but that we're really kind of rotten, but if we do good things, we will be okay. And what we're doing is working against a negative core ego concept. And usually what we do is we find some individual difference in ourself that we can connect with this thing and thus blame it. I used to be overwhelmed when I was a psychotherapist by the fact that each person had her or his thing. And each person said, if it wasn't for this, it would be okay. If I didn't have a nose that was shaped this way, if my breasts were bigger or smaller, if I was having better orgasms, if I had come from a richer family, if I were a different color, if my parents hadn't broken up when I was young, if I hadn't fallen and gotten this scar when I was little, if I didn't have such big genitals, if I didn't have such small genitals, if my hair was a different color, if I had lived in a neighborhood where I had more kids to play with, if I had had a more compassionate father, everybody's got their thing. Okay? I may not have hit yours exactly, but I hit a good 40% of us right just now. And we get so emotionally preoccupied with the thing that's wrong with us that it starts to color all of the ways in which we see the world around us. So that if you are preoccupied with your nose, you then notice noses. And you notice everybody, and you notice all the successful people particularly, and what nice noses they had. Okay? And so on. In the course of sadhana, of spiritual journey, of awakening, of deepening of meditation, our social perceptions keep changing. And many of us, I would say almost most of us, are in the peculiar predicament that we have built a whole ego structure about who we are and how we function, emotionally laden habits about individual differences. But now we are experiencing realms of the universe and perceptions of ourselves and others that are totally inconsistent with these habits of thought about who we are. And the problem is we can't give up yet because they were so overlearned, those original habits. The image that I have, which I may have mentioned to you, is the one of using yourself as your perceptual field as a microscope. It's like tuning from channel 7 to channel 6 on television, channel 5, channel 4. Because if you look at another person first, the way you are traditionally looking at them, you look at them in terms of, first of all, your own desire systems. So, as I've said before, if you're horny, you see who's makeable, who's a competitor for who's makeable, or who's irrelevant. That's your way of dividing the universe. If you're an achiever or a power-oriented person or you're localized in your third chakra, you look at who's beatable or who's going to beat you out or who you have more power than, and you see everybody in domains of power and realms of power and control. If you're a physical gymnast, you look at people in terms of their body development. If you were a scientist of body development, you might be a Sheldon somatotypist. And you would look at people in terms of whether they are endomorphs, mesomorphs, or ectomorphs. And you'd say there's a 377 or a 422, depending on whether the shoulders were big and the hips narrow, or the hips nigh tall and thin, or short and fat, or whatever. If your preoccupation is color, you are aware of color. If your preoccupation is sex, sexual male or female, you are aware of that dimension, always in looking at another person. Is it a man or a woman I'm looking at? If you have a sexual preoccupation that is deviant from the culture, cultural norm supposedly, you will be very aware of that dimension in everybody else. Now, if you flipped the microscope one little flip, and you look a little deeper into another person, what you begin to see is personality. And then you see everybody as, that's a cheerful person. That person is very pleasant. That person seems depressed. And those of us that are preoccupied on the lower astral planes where our personalities exist, see only other people as personality. That person was nice to me. That's a nice woman. Nice woman. She's sort of motherly. That's a psychological variable. And we look in psychological dimensions at other people. Okay, if you flip it once more into another astral plane, you will see astrological things, as I mentioned before. And then there are only 12 permutations in the world. And you see everybody as Leo or Aries and Sagittarius. And when you look at another person, that's what you see. You say, I'm seeing a Leo. Person says, I'm not a Leo, my name is Fred. You say, well, that's what you think you are, but in fact you are a Leo. Because I see a Leo when I look, right? And that's the reality of that plane. If you go one more flip, what you see when you look at another person is another person and they're looking back at you. Okay. You look into their eyes and you see somebody else. Are you in there? I'm here, far out. And you look at your packaging. And you see the packaging. The packaging involves the astral, all the individual differences. There's still somebody separate from you in there, but the individual differences are more like the veils or the packaging of the product. You can say, you in there, I'm in here. Here we are. We're two beings. Two beings. Now, you take a relationship, say, to your mother or your father or your child, who you've got this long history of treating them. That's mother. That's father. That's my son. That's my daughter. That's Janie. That's Mary Jane. It's little Mary Jane. Hello, little Mary Jane. And then you flip the microscope with Mary Jane, and suddenly there's another being inside Mary Jane who isn't Mary Jane at all. It's not Mary Jane. It's not like it's Sarah Lou. It's not anybody. It's just another being saying, I'm in here too. I'm just like you. Now, what happens is, for efficiency, so that we can sleepwalk through life, it is usually most efficient to get completely into individual differences and treat everybody just like they were yesterday. So if you were Mary Jane yesterday, you'll probably be Mary Jane today. And if I've treated you as somebody who's a slob, I might as well continue to treat you as a slob. That's known as efficiency of social relationships. Because if every time I meet another person, instead of being preoccupied with individual differences, I go through them and I see another being who's just like me, well, it's a whole new ball game every time we meet. Like, who are you this time? Oh, I'm still Mary Jane. Okay. We'll play that one out today. Now, it gets very, very far out because, for example, in my relation with my father is busy thinking he is my father, right? He knows who he is. He's a Republican. He's a man in his middle 70s. He's somebody who loves his family. He's a good man, right? He owns this and that, etc. He likes the ball games. He knows who he is. The problem is that who that is dying sooner or later. He's already beyond the actuarial age. And not only that, but if he is busy being who he is, and I'm then into the symbiotic role in relation, the complementary role in relation to that, so I'm busy being his son. But the thing is, I'm 43, and it's funny about what a son is at 43, you know. The limits of our relationship are very two-dimensional. They're very flat. But on the other hand, from where I'm sitting, he's just another being. And it just happens that in this lifetime, we took incarnations in which this particular round, he was incarnated. His karma was that I was his son. Heavy karma. My karma was that he was my father, right? Right. We are each other's karmic predicament, if you will. Right? But behind it all, you here, I'm here, far out. Okay? Now, if I say to him, are you here, I'm here, he doesn't know what the hell I'm talking about. Oh, you're talking that nut talk again. Right? Okay. And so my job isn't to come on to him at all. And the Gita makes that very clear in the third chapter. Let not the wise disturb the mind of the unwise in their work. Let him working with devotion show them the joy of good work. And those who are under the delusion of the forces of nature bind themselves to the work of these forces. Let not the man who sees this disturb the one who sees it not. My job isn't to say to him, look, you're not my father, really. Really? Really? Okay. Because he's got a birth certificate and the whole thing. Okay? From that reality, right? But the point is that my perception of him is another being who is in an incarnation in which he is totally identified with the thoughts that are connected with that incarnation. And he is so deeply identified with them that it is all totally real from how he's looking at it. So we will sit down together and we will talk father and son talk. But all the time, I'm doing my mantra, and I'm sitting in the place inside myself, which is merely another plane. It's no better or worse than the one he's on. It's just a different one, in which we are two beings who are doing this dance together. And what my mind is doing is creating a space, which, if he chooses, he is free to give up the limiting conditions of the role that he has been thinking he is. And what will happen to us sometimes is very far out. We will talk father and son talk, and then we'll keep sitting with one another. And then we'll run out of father and son talk, and we'll still be together. And because I feel so peaceful in that, while most people, if they are caught in their roles, get freaked when the role material runs out, when you've run out of script line. But I'll sit with it, and pretty soon we will just be sitting together, just as if we were meditating in the Naropa Center. And we can't have any words about it because the minute we come into concepts, we immediately go back into models. But we have left words behind and we're just together. Right? It turns out, I mean, if you want to go further mystically and do another flip, you get so you're looking at yourself when you look at somebody else. And it's all yourself dancing with yourself, making believe you're separate. But that's too far out for us, most of us. The point is that no matter what your relationship is with who, the same rules apply. It doesn't matter whether it's your parent or your child or your enemy or your friend or your therapy patient or your therapist. You treat them all the same way. You treat them with compassion. You treat them with an appreciation of the fact that we are beings who are in incarnations. You quiet yourself. You center yourself. And then it's all possible. And in every relationship, it's all possible. That is, you become the environment because you're not laying trips on everybody around you all the time. Because you're not sitting around judging. You should be this way. If you were a good father, you'd be. Okay? My child is going to be. Okay? I'm hoping that for my therapy patients that they will. I expected more from a therapist than. Can you hear all those places? Okay. I expect my husband to. See, the predicament is that everybody is doing just what they can do. Maharaji kept saying to me, Ramdas, don't you see it's all perfect? Everybody's being just who, everybody is a perfect. Like when you go out in the woods and you see all the trees, you don't say, well, that tree isn't like that tree. I wish it were, you know, if that tree didn't bend like that, it would be a good tree. Somehow with trees, you can allow it. You can allow that each tree is just perfect the way it is. But when you get to people, if everybody isn't just like you think they ought to be, all hell breaks loose. You sit around judging and judging and judging and judging and having opinions. And there is a whole other way of looking at these gunas, these strands of the universe, interacting and seeing how in each individual manifestation, these strands have merged in such a way to lead to another perfect statement of the unstatable. Right? So that you look at somebody who comes up and who's hung up and tight and angry and insecure and anxious and frightened, and you see the perfection of it far out. And you give each incarnation space to manifest as it needs to manifest. You know, 5 years ago, I was busy trying to change my father. And now I have grown enough so I can leave him alone. I can just love him as he is. Now, the predicament we have about human relationships is recognizing that certain relationships have been laid on us by God karmically for this entire incarnation. You don't trade in your father. You don't trade in your child. You may try. Whether or not you trade in your husband or wife is an interesting issue in this culture at this moment. In every religion, when you married, you took on the same kind of karmic commitment that you did with a father or a mother or a child. It was till death do us part. We've converted that because when we got totally profane, we started to see it as merely a comfortable social arrangement. And when it didn't work, you changed it. And since that is the cultural format in which most of the marriages have taken place that exist in this room, at this point, you live within the culture you're dealing with. You didn't enter into the marriages consciously with an understanding till death do us part. Because you weren't conscious enough to make a vow like that. It's like making the bodhisattva vow. You can't enter into it until you know what you're doing. As you get more conscious, the nature of the contracts you enter into change considerably, and you enter in much more consciously to which contracts, how, and for how long. But at the moment, there are certain contractual relationships you're involved in which are givens you're not going to get out of in this lifetime, and there are others that when you get finished with them, you can walk away and form new ones. And you can make the differentiation between those kinds of karmic commitments. But if you try to walk away from one prematurely, if you can look back with an astral eye, you will see these long threads going to these beings. Like somebody who splits from home and, screw you, I'm leaving. You know, maybe the work was done, but methinks it wasn't. There's a subtle flow of emotions that suggests that it wasn't quite all done. I'm leaving you and I'm taking the children. I finished my work with you. You know, doesn't sound that way to me. You know, you may go away for a while, but that's okay. Later on, you'll be cooler and you'll understand. You can't go through the door as long as you leave unfulfilled karmic stuff behind you. Now, sometimes you've walked away from somebody and then they die. You say, oh, I've blown it. Not necessarily. When you get totally centered, you can run through the relationship with them and bring it up to date consciously. Life and death isn't what it's about, as we'll talk about on Tuesday. Historically, we have all been very deeply involved in a romantic image of ourselves. And that romanticizing is part of what would be called personality level. It's a low astral, and the whole astral planes, all of the planes are romantic. So that you may finish with the physical plane identity, and you say, well, I know that I'm not Joe anymore, but who I am is the Messiah. But don't tell anybody just yet, because I'm not ready to manifest. What you find is that behind the physical plane, there are all these other planes in which you have also identities, and they all have more energy connected with them than this one, so when you get into one, it seems more real than this one did, and you get sucked in. And a lot of us, through various ways, have moved into other planes and gotten very much enamored of new identities, and are still as much caught in individual differences as we were before. And the game always is to just keep letting go and letting go. And Maharaji's statement, sub-ek, has been my saving thing. Sub-ek, there's only one. Now, you and I can sit around and, like angels on a head of a pin debate, discuss whether the one and the zero are the same thing, and whether the one is an illusion. But for our point of view, from where we start, pardon me, from the poverty position, from where my work is reassuringly helped a lot by the one. And I remember a dialogue I had with Trungpa in front of some television cameras in Vermont last year, when Trungpa was teaching a seminar on Don Juan. And he said to me, Ram Dass, what do you do about sorcerers? And I said, what sorcerers? I don't see any sorcerers. And he says, don't cop out, what do you do about sorcerers? I said, Trungpa, I don't notice all that stuff. I just notice God. There's all one. It's none of my business. I'm just aiming for the one. Now, he and I have been having a continuing dialogue, which is a very interesting one, about responsibility. And if I can say it clearly, if I deny the sorcerers and deny this physical plane with evil and good, deny the planes of evil and good and individual differences, I am caught in denial for fear of all of this stuff, and I am no less hung up than if I had been totally preoccupied with individual differences and failed to appreciate that behind it all lies the one. And what my growth is that I am growing into being able to assume the responsibility in the realm of individual differences at the same moment, keeping fully aware of the fact that one lies behind it all. And that's where that blend, that as Trungpa said to me one day, it's a very fine line between accepting the responsibility for individual differences. Like I say to people, and they get very aggravated with me, they say, oh, thank you, you're wonderful, and you've done so much for my life. I said, I don't do anything. I'm just a pawn in the game. And they say, oh, come on, stop kidding me. Now, from where I'm sitting, that's the most real thing I can say. At another level, it is true that I am doing something or other. And if I deny one level and cling to another, I'm still caught. So when people say, thank you, I say, you're welcome. And when they say, you didn't do it, I say, you're right. Okay? And you got to live with all that stuff all at once. Right? Now, you begin to notice, as you start to begin to be a connoisseur of the law, of the universe, of the divine law, that nothing seems to be happening by chance anymore. That who you meet in the supermarket, who you meet in the street, isn't random. Who you end up going to bed with isn't random, no matter even if you've gotten to the philosophy where you think it is. All of it is lawfully working out each individual's karma. And then you say, my God, what a computer system must be behind this. See? I mean, you read in the Hasid literature that not a leaf turns, but that God does not know. You think, far out. A leaf turning? You know, like you sit and the wind blows and the leaves roll by and you think somebody planned all that? Far out. That's total paranoia. Okay. Well, that's what law is. It's total paranoia. I don't mean it. Right, okay. And as I said before, that when you start to get angry at people, like when, at this point, it's pretty good now. When somebody really infuriates me, I get infuriated. I roar, and I'm really fierce these days. And as I'm doing my fierce thing and the adrenaline's pumping and I'm just getting into my, I'm going to manifest my, you know, other form, okay, the cosmic humor of the predicament starts to sneak in. Okay, got you again. Okay. They get to a model you've got going about how you think it ought to be. And since your game of awakening is to ferret out those places in you where you're clinging to models of this or that, what can more can you ask for than that somebody would come along to wake you up again? Okay. And if they can get you furious, isn't that nice of them? Isn't that a compassionate act? Not necessarily conscious compassion on their part, but in terms of your relation to your guru who sent the person, who is the person. What a compassionate act to really get me bugged. Thank you. See? Now, how long does it take you in that sequence of little mind trips, mind moments, before you go from the rrr, which is individual differences level, to here I am in an incarnation going rrr, see? To reestablishing the place in you where far out, look at the rrr, see? And what's fun is when you're playing with other beings called satsang or sangha who are equally conscious and working on themselves, and you go, rrr, and the other person goes, rrr, and you're both looking at each other saying, far out, look at this one. Okay. And that's why it gets very heady to hang around satsang, because there is an assumption that everybody's on the trip together, and we're really helping each other wake up, and we get caught in these incredible melodramas, but there is, behind it all, there is the cosmic joke. And that's why having this other connection, whether to the guru or to the mantra, or whatever it is that you have a connection, it's that third thing that keeps you from getting lost in the two all the time. So it's like when you're making love, keep the guru in the room. So there's always a third consciousness, just a pure, non-judgmental, totally compassionate, totally loving consciousness present. Always. Everywhere you are, everything you're doing. And you just keep running your life off against that until pretty soon you've just incorporated that whole philosophy, that whole spacious, present, calm, in which ongoing is pleasure and pain and joy and sorrow and so on. Within the romantic image is the word loneliness. And a lot of people feel very lonely when they get into certain psychodynamic, psychological spaces where they don't make contact with others. You will find in the spiritual journey that you come into intense experiences of aloneness. But if you examine them carefully, you will find out that they are very different from loneliness. And that it ends up that we are all alone. We are all alone. And there begins very early in the game to be the flickering recognition of that all aloneness. We are not alone, my friend. Not because there are so many others, but because there are none. It's another kind of aloneness, not loneliness. But again, when we get these certain experiences, we put our old habits of thinking, lay them on them, in order to interpret them in a certain way. I was reading about anger. I just wanted to read you this letter I got from a lovely gal in New York. Here in New York, working on not getting in the way of music, working at being one with it, the whole population is a gigantic, intricate, triumphant, funny, sad work in progress. Downtown on the east side, I saw an angry woman shaking her fist at a truck driver who had cut her off. She was sputtering with rage, trying to find words. Finally, she shouted, you weird expression of God, you. Last time we were talking about the way Swami Muktananda would meditate, incorporating the guru into himself. And it is not a bad meditation for us at this moment, if you want to do a contemplative meditation, to sit down and meditate on your own divinity, on your own beauty, just to start to dislodge, force to the surface all that negative stuff you've got about who you think you are. I've got to tell you an interesting story. Let's take a moment. There was a time a few years ago when, this was in 1964 or 5, Tim Leary and I had been partners for several years, and we got to the point where we were disagreeing about strategies, and we separated for a while. But we still had a joint involvement because I was the treasurer and director of the corporation, and we were running Millbrook. And I came back from Europe, and I came to Millbrook, and Timothy was then running Millbrook. I had been running it for the year previously. He had been away in India. And Timothy and I were in great odds, which we've since reconciled to a much deeper love. And at one point, I was at that time the legal guardian of his children, because he had been away and so on. And I was very close to his kids. And he said, he came to his kids one night, and I was sitting there, and he says, "Kids, I have to tell you this, that Uncle Richard," which is who I was then, "Uncle Richard is evil." Now, Timothy had a good Catholic upbringing, and that might have meant something to him. It didn't mean a hell of a lot to me. And his son said to him, "Oh, come on, Dad. He may be a schnook, but he's not evil." You know? And he said, no, I've got to tell you that Uncle Richard is evil. And, of course, I lost my cool at that point, which I was very good at doing in those days. And I said to him, "Well, Timothy, if I'm evil, you're psychotic." Right? Which got to him, as I knew it would, and we were both totally freaked, right? Well, I left Millbrook at that point, and I went to California. And this thing started to work in my head, you know. Gee, you know, I've done an awful lot of rotten things in my life. Do you suppose I am evil? Do you suppose there's like something really just basically corrupt and rotten in me? You know? And about in the fall, I was with a gal who we had been together for a while, and we took LSD together one night. And right in the middle of the session, I told her this thing. I said, "You know, Timothy thinks I'm evil." So in the state we were in at that moment, she looked at me, and what I turned into, I can't imagine, but she said, "Well, maybe you are, you know." Well, that was the end of that relationship. I became impotent, and she ran off with another man, and a whole scene came. So I kept working with this problem. You suppose I'm evil? You know, gee, I must be. I guess maybe I'm really evil. And then around February of that year, I took a very deep acid trip by myself. And I went in, and I went to where I really felt evil. You know, I stood in front of a mirror and became as evil as I could. And it was, and I went through all my evil thoughts. I was really scaring the hell out of myself, you know. Literally. And then I went back and back and back. And I came to a place in me where I just am. I do a lot of crummy things, and I do a lot of beautiful things, and I'm neither good nor evil. I just am. There's good, there's evil, and I am. I realize that's true of everybody, but suddenly that was a recognition. Again, I touched it before, but I had never had the predicament where my best friend said, "You're evil," so I had never had the opportunity to work as intensely with it as this. So from then on, I was really quite liberated from that whole issue of good and evil, which I have been, actually, since then, except in subtle ways where it sneaks back in on me. And it was about a year and a half later, Tim had been busted in Laredo, and we had set up the defense fund, and we were still very cold, but we were working together. And I was then living in New York City, and one night we got a call. Carolyn said, "Tim wants to talk to you." It was around 2 in the morning. It was the people at Millbrook, and they said, "Tim's taken a chemical, and he's been calling for you all night." I hadn't seen him in 6 months or so. So the next morning, we rented a car, and we drove up to Millbrook, and I came to see Timothy. And I walked into the room, and Timothy was lying on the floor, and he got up, and he came over, and he embraced me. And he said, "I just want you to know one thing." I said, "What's that, Timothy?" He says, "You're not evil." Right? Okay. And I said, "Well, thank you." I said, "I already found that out, but I appreciate what you did for me. Okay? Because if you hadn't laid that trip on me, I never would have done that work. Even though it was incredibly suffery, you know, there was a lot of suffering involved in that whole business. But that suffering was such incredible grace in terms of my own evolution. And if I can keep reiterating to you that the quicker you can get the perception where you understand that suffering is grace, the more you're going to have all of it become the teaching, all of it, and you won't just get preoccupied with self-pity. As I said to you, Gurdjieff said, what you have to give up is suffering. And as you purify and as you meditate deeply, more deeply, you become a more pure seeker, and that purity of seeking makes you keep seeing through the illusion over and over and over again. I want to read to you, the purest devotee of Krishna, even purer than Arjuna, because Arjuna was still doubting and not sure and so on, even purer than that was Radha, because Radha was the gopi, the milkmaid, she was the devotee whose love for God was just so passionate and total that she just could, that's all she thought about was coming to God. She was the perfect devotee. And here the milkmaids are all down by the river washing. They're dancing. As we were dancing yesterday, they came into our midst, suddenly slipping in amongst us on noiseless feet, this other milkmaid, this gopi, whom I recognized, this is one of the milkmaids talking, whom I recognized as Malati. I called out, "Why Malati?" in surprise. But at the same instant, another gopi cried, "My sister." And another said, "Nay, it is my niece." And a third said, "My cousin." And a fourth said, "It's my little daughter." But then, lo, I looked, and it was not Malati. It was Pushpavati, my elder sister-in-law. I rubbed my eyes and heard one say, "Oh, mother, how hast thou come here?" And another, "Behold, my aunt hath come to join the rasa." And another said, "You're blind, it's Kusumavati, my brother's wife." And so they fell to quarreling and called one another blind and foolish and deluded. Suddenly Radha, who had joined us a while since, laughed sweetly and clapped her hands and cried in a voice like silver bells, "Ah, it is Krishna. Come forth, thy tease, I recognize thee." The purity of her vision. Whereupon the new gopi vanished, and Krishna stood before us, feet crossed, body swaying, the flute to his smiling lips, his brilliant eyes laughing into ours. For a moment he stood thus, then he ran to Radha and knelt before her. "Hail, O goddess, chief among bhaktas, thou alone amongst all these can see Krishna through all disguises. Thine eyes, purified by love, can pierce the curtain of Maya and fix the reality beyond. The work with each other is that work. The work is not getting lost in individual differences. Honor them, recognize them. Honor them in yourself, work with them. Your dharma will be a function of your individual differences, but don't get lost in them. Keep looking behind through your love of truth or your love of the one or your love of reality until every relationship becomes more of the teaching. Because until you are free, the only work you have to do is the work on yourself. And everything you do with everybody becomes a vehicle for that work on yourself. I did say today we would have questions, and today we will have questions. The questions can be about anything we've had thus far, since except death, because that's coming up. Yes. Would I speak a bit more about what I mean about the trap of meditation? Well, there are at different levels of sadhana, there are different kinds of traps in each method. For example, in bhakti or devotional yoga, there is the trap of getting caught in this dualistic love of God where it's so, you put yourself down and put that up and you just keep that dualism and you're always looking for God, and that's lower bhakti. The higher bhakti that the Gita talks about is where you have recognized you're coming into the Brahman, that nirvanic space, and at that place you recognize the love and the law, and then your love becomes devotional at a higher bhakti place. In meditation, you can get caught in what are called the jhanas, first of all, which you may understand, the jhanic states, which are like trance states, if you will, which are often almost imitative of the higher planes, like the state of emptiness can be a jhana. And you can, or the state of bliss, there are some that have incredible rapture and bliss and emptiness, and you get so hooked on the rapture, bliss, and emptiness that you become like a junkie in a way. You're a meditation junkie, and you don't go through it, you just sit with it. And these things can hang you for a long time. And that's why in evolved stages of meditation, it's very good to have a meditation teacher whom you come to and you say, "I just did this." And meditation teacher says, "That's stage 6394 sub 2. Now go and meditate on this, and that'll take you through that one." See? It's like I was meditating in a Southern Buddhist meditation. I suddenly got this incredible pressure up in my forehead, and I thought, far out, my third eye's opening, how wonderful. And I went to my teacher and I said, I have this tremendous pressure. And I thought I'm going to say, oh, great, you are as great as I thought you were, you know. And he said to me, go out in the field and spread your arm out and send it down your arm and out your fingertips. I said, what? I've been looking for it for years. He says, it'll do you no good. And it was because I wasn't doing an energy meditation then. I was doing a different kind. And I needed him to cut me loose from being attached to the experiences that come during meditation. So that's more what I mean by that kind of attachment. A lot of people get into meditation is good and life is rotten. And in a way, I think that Trungpa's book, Meditation in Action, is a real up-level on that in bringing it into... I'm not talking about that kind of meditation as the hang-up. Although, it's very delicate. Yeah, no, I'm not. Yeah. The question about conscious use of vehicles in society and the... Like, take advertising, which is what Richard asked me to take. First of all, is the rule that there is no form to the spirit. That when you are totally free, you can work with any form. There are styles of life of high beings that are very confusing to us because they don't seem nice the way we're used to it. But we begin to sense that they are compassionate in a way that the sword of discrimination or Shiva's fire only burns away that which is burnable. It only burns the chaff from the wheat. It leaves the pure thing. A conscious being can work with anything and use it in a way to liberate other beings because they have no other motive than to liberate. If you are less than conscious, then you will find that you use everything in a combination of ways that liberate people and also entrap them. And certain vehicles are more difficult to use in a liberating fashion than others. And the case point is advertising, that when you are trying to convert somebody else, the way in which advertising works often is it fans desires in people to get them to want more worldly stuff. And I think at the stage that I am at, I must be very cautious that all of the acts I am involved in are very dharmic in a limiting sense of dharma, not in the total expansive sense of dharma. That is, at this moment, I have to tell the truth. I can't lie. Later, I may be able to lie. And I'm saying that honestly. Later I can lie, but now I must tell the truth. Maharaji, I spent a long time dealing with this contradiction that Maharaji would say, tell the truth, and then he'd lie. Till I realized he could lie and I had to tell the truth. And that's okay, I can understand that now. Later I can lie when I grow up. Okay, that's the poverty program. All right. So in certain advertising, like for example, when I talk to you about joining Naropa's spring program next year, that's advertising. I am doing it because in my heart, Naropa's spring program next year is dharmic. I couldn't advertise for something. The prison project is dharmic. The Hanuman Foundation feels dharmic to me. If it didn't, I couldn't do it. Later, maybe I can. Later, maybe I can say to you, what you really need is to have this special zafu with embroidered silk this, because if you can't do that, you can't meditate properly. But at the moment, I don't believe that. So that I'm saying that while there is no form to the spirit, at certain stages of your sadhana, you are primarily involved with purification, and you must be careful that everything you're involved with is dharmic. Like my whole way of right livelihood must be dharmic. My relations to human beings must be dharmic in the narrowest sense of what I consciously understand with my limited light to be that which liberates people. So that limits the kinds of games I can play. I really can't do rip-off games at this point. And just saying, well, I'm earning a living this way, but I'm using it for God, and I can earn it by screwing other people, I can't do that. At this stage, I can't do it. We had this interesting thing where, like when we were at Millbrook, our money was primarily coming from the Mellon family. And the Mellon family primarily were getting their money from things like Gulf Oil, which they owned, and Alcoa Aluminum and stuff like that. And Gulf Oil was primarily exploiting natives in underdeveloped countries in terms of getting oil. So ultimately, we were ripping off somebody to get this money to do good with. Now, I can say, well, we were using it for good and therefore transmuting the energy. And that's a nice model, and I think one does the best one can with where one's at. You don't say, I won't touch it because it's dirty money. But you've got to consciously know what you're doing. As I said last time about eating meat or anything, if you're going to work with money, work with it consciously. Know what you're doing and bring to it all of your consciousness. If you're going to take a job that doesn't feel truly dharmic, bring to it as much consciousness as you can. Some of you may feel, I can only do a job that's dharmic. I'd rather starve to death rather than earn money impurely. Others say, look, I'll do the best I can under the conditions. And there's no blame in either case. Each of us has to hear what each of us has to do. If you're a sadhu, if you're a single renunciate, woman or man, then you can afford to be quite a purist, as I can. I have nobody dependent on me. On the other hand, if you have family, you are a householder and you have certain responsibilities and you got to do the best you can. Because if you are such a purist, you don't get enough money to feed your baby, in the long run, you've done more adharma than dharma. Questions? Yes. Could I say a little more about the experience of looking at someone and seeing that it's yourself? I put in the manual a thing called satsang collaboration, which we ended up not doing as a group thing because it was a little too complicated at this level of the game. But I'd recommend to you that you consider it, and the way I'd recommend you do it is you sit down opposite somebody. It could be a friend or a relative or nobody you know. Look between the other person's eyes, right in between their eyes, and then you can see both eyes, so your eyes don't have to flick back and forth, which eye am I looking into? Don't do it as a social thing. Just sit with one another looking at your eyes and make the eyes the focus point of about a 40-minute meditation. Set a timer and then just sit there. And then let it all happen to you. Let you see all the other things in the other person. Let you experience the feelings you have as you're being looked at by another person. Just keep looking and looking and looking, and pretty soon you will start to see the face around the eyes changing, and sometimes it'll become incredibly horrible and sometimes incredibly beautiful. Don't let it do anything. Don't let it suck you in. Just stay right with the eyes and just say, and this too, and this too. Because you have to look at your 10,000 horrible visions and your 10,000 beautiful visions and let them go by too. And you just keep looking and looking, and pretty soon all of the stuff of it all starts to become ground rather than figure, and you begin to see deeper and deeper and deeper until you're just looking at another being looking back at you. And my suggestion to you is that the best way you can understand about this is to sit down and do it, something that can be experienced. It is the place where individual differences look like background and not figure anymore. It's the place you know so well when you look at somebody you've known for a long time you know that they're an incredibly beautiful person, and then somebody looks at them in a way that you see that they are looking at them from a cultural beauty point of view, and you realize that that person's really ugly culturally, but is so beautiful inside you never even noticed. And that's the level. You go in and in until all the different levels start to fall away as dominant themes. Yes. A little bit more about aloneness and loneliness. Well, loneliness is part of the melodrama. Like you're alone and everybody's left you, and you're in your room and nobody cares, you're unloved, and you're full of self-pity, and you're sitting there and you're lonely. And to the extent that you have any centering or meditative position left, or any kind of connection, there is that little cosmic humor voice in you says, boy, is this terrible. Look at this self-pity. You could cut it with a knife. Am I lonely? And there is a connoisseur in you that is appreciating the essence of loneliness, the kind of intense quality of the suffering. And as you sit quieter with that, or with any of your emotional states, you begin to experience a peace right in the midst of the melodrama. And that peace is a peace in which you feel totally quiet. It is not a social sense. Now, let me explain something about the aloneness part of it. I used to shoot DMT a lot, dimethyltryptamine. Some of you smoked it, but in the old days we used to take it intramuscularly. And it was known as the businessman special. It was a 30-minute LSD high. You go up and 30 minutes later you come down. So I used to take it all the time before lectures or things so I could clear my head. I remember once I took it, I was going to do the David Susskind show, and I took a shot up with DMT in a New York apartment, and the first thing I experienced was that I was out in the desert and I was a whirling dervish. And I started to whirl faster and faster and faster. And I started to whirl up into the sky. And I suddenly looked down, and there was my body on the desert. And I kept whirling up, and it was cloudy, and I whirled through the layer of clouds. Now, I, at the time, had a plane, and I was a pilot, so I tended to have pilot imagery a lot. And I whirled up through the clouds, and I came out into where the sun is. Those of you that have flown, you know, you fly up through the clouds of the smog in Los Angeles, and you suddenly there's the sun. It's been there all the time. And I flew up till it was really clear. It was more like nighttime, but it was a luminous blue quality. And I flipped up through, and I was like a little point of light. And I looked out, and way out in the distance, there were these other little flicks of light coming up. And I recognized those were the Himalayas. And then I saw little flicks there, and that was San Francisco. And I saw these little flicks coming through, and we could look across at one another and recognize one another. And after a period of time, we went back down through the smog and back down into the world again. Now, it turns out that what we all are starting to have is a satsang, or a community of the spirit, or a community of consciousness that is not in time and space. But we are so habituated that we keep running through old dramas, even though we've used them up. So that you get this experience where somebody goes away from you and you say, oh, I'll miss you, and you go through a whole melodrama of goodbye, I'll miss you, it's horrible you're leaving. And yet, a few minutes later, you're fully involved in what you're doing right now. And when you see them again, it seemed like a moment. Like last night, I called a fellow in Texas who I was a graduate student with 20 years ago. I last saw him 12 years ago, he and his wife. And I called them, and we started to talk on the phone, and within 2 minutes, we were right here. And those 12 years were like just a... they were gone. And this guy kept saying to me, gee, it'll certainly be wonderful to see you again. And I said, well, what the hell do you think you're doing now? Like, here we are. Do you think if our bodies, these big, grotesque, decaying bodies get together, see, and we hug and we do a thing, it'll somehow be more here than it was before? Or what about the telephone? Was that really necessary? I knew they were here. They knew I was here. Now, it's not at the level of knowing. It's at the level of being that I say to people, there is nobody I could ever miss again, because nobody could ever get away from me again, nor I from them, because I don't live on the physical time-space plane. And when you start to live not on the physical time-space plane, you realize that our coming and going isn't what it's about. And when you realize our coming and going is not what it's about, you could never be lonely again. You couldn't possibly be lonely again. Because where could you go? I mean, how could I get away from my guru? I've already told you what his trip is about. Think if I go in my bathroom and lock the door, I can be lonely? I can't be. It's always just one thought away. The living spirit, the community of our consciousness, that guru inside, or however you want to call it, is always one thought away. And when you're busy being lonely, all you're going to do is sit down and meditate. Because one thought away, the minute you give up the thought of yourself as separate, which is the one that's lonely, here we are again. And when you are in the here we are again, there is a place where you tune your microscope, where there's another being and another being and another being just like me, but if you tune it once more, there is only one of it. And that is the great aloneness, it's called. And that is the place that comes through very, very deep meditative space. The experience of the fact that all forms and all separateness is just passing show. It's just stuff. And there really is only, that's the aloneness, the aloneness. And when you live in that, you know that though you'll meet many people, you will always be alone. Not lonely, but always be alone. Not separate, but always be alone. Yes. Would I talk a little bit more about the way in which Maharaji is an incarnation of Hanuman? We get a little freaked because Hanuman was a monkey, and we have all these associations about monkeys. But as Maharaji said, Hanuman and Christ were the same. They just came at different times, and they played different roles, so they took on different forms. Such beings often can reincarnate. Now, I've got to be very delicate about this topic, which I will out front say is the topic of the avataric form. And rather than get all complicated about judgment of who's what, let me say this. That it is entirely possible, in fact, it does happen, that some beings are born onto this physical plane into an illusion which is very thin, And in the course of this, their final lifetime, they clear away the illusion and they are left there as a free being available to serve others as a statement of the Dharma. That's one type of being that becomes, quote, the guru or the realized being. There is another kind of being who starts as a causal thought form, since if you can look at the relation between planes or vibrational levels or realities, if you will, they are interrelated in such a way that the denser, such as this, is all related to the more subtle and less dense, the least subtle and least dense of which is the thought or the word. In the beginning is the word, which is the causal plane when Prakriti starts. So that the beginning of form starts with thought or an idea, and then it forms into thicker and thicker stuff, emotions, personality, color, light, sound, all down into solids. It is entirely conceivable, in fact it does happen, that beings who are in the realm of thought forms will then take a manifestation on the physical plane. They will be born consciously, and they will do their work consciously, and depart consciously, and do the whole trip. They had no sadhana to do in themselves. They were a conscious being that came for a specific purpose. And these beings come from different planes, and there are lower level ones and higher level ones. And then there is the conceivability that behind all of forms there is the One, and the One manifests on the physical plane as well as being the One. That is the final avataric form. That's what Krishna is in the Gita. That is the form where at some times when Krishna is talking, he is Krishna the charioteer for Arjuna, and at some times he's the one behind all other possibilities, including the Brahman and the Prakriti and all of it, Ishwara and so on. Now, all I can say, I have no idea anything about where Maharaji fits into the game of all of this. I don't even care, because when your love is pure enough, you couldn't care less about somebody's genealogy. At the same time, there have been enough clues, although Maharaji was very obtuse about his history, there are enough clues to suggest that his link to Hanuman was more than one of respect. Little clues like, for example, when there is a reading of the Ramayana at one point, the story of Ram, and in this story, Hanuman does something. Maharaji's sitting there, and the pujari's about to, the pundit is about to read from the Ramayana, and Maharaji says to him, read the part where I say, right? Just those little ones, and everybody freezes. There was a railroad executive who came to see Maharaji for the first time, and he walked into the temple, and he looked at where Maharaji was sitting, and what he saw was a 15-foot monkey. He didn't see Maharaji at all, and he passed out cold. And when they revived him, he said, I just saw this huge monkey. There have been, in Maharaji's room, there have been things like monkey footprints where there were no monkeys. People who have been very devoted to Maharaji have seen him suddenly disappear into his room, bringing his tail in behind him. It's always this little, oh, come on, you know, at the same moment, there it is. I'm satisfied to have him just be old Maharaji, you know. I mean, I don't need him to be a monkey. But, oh well. Yes. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna comments about him being Soma. Would you comment about that? Why, yes. I would love to, now that you've asked. I thought you'd never ask. Soma, or the elixir, or the ambrosia of the gods, the drink that spiritizes, the drink that transmutes, right? As some of you know, when I went to India the first time, you've read about it and Be Here Now, I was carrying LSD and I was wondering what it was, and Maharaji said, let me see what you got, let me see the medicine. And he proceeded to take 900 micrograms, three caps, and nothing happened. And I came back to America and I wrote about it and told about it, but the inside me was this gnawing little wonder. Do you suppose through hypnotic suggestion, or because I was so flipped out in those days or whatever, that he took the three pills and he threw them over his head and he didn't really take them? and he was just putting me on. So when I went to India in 1970, I got called up before Maharaji one day, and he said to me, did you give me some medicine last time I was you were in India? Yes, Maharaji. Did I take it? Well, I think so. He said, what happened? I said, nothing. Oh, Jao, go away. So I went away. Next morning he calls me up, he says, you got any more of that medicine? Yeah. Bring it. So I brought it and I had 5 pills, one of which was broken. So he took the 4 that weren't broken, which was now 1,200 micrograms. And he took each one and he stuck it on his tongue. Went a whole thing so there'd be no doubt in my mind at all, see. I mean, he knew I represented all of us, and he was sending back the message, and he... And when he had swallowed all 4 of them, he said, Pani, can I take water? I said, yeah. Garam, Tanda, Hutter, Kola, it doesn't matter. Pani, bring Pani. And he takes and he drinks some water, and he says, will it make me crazy? So I said to him, probably. Whatever you want, you can do, Because the time I had given him the acid last time, a sadhu then said to me, well, that's nothing. He said, a couple of years ago, he said, a sadhu came to see Maharaji, and he had some sadhus take arsenic for devotional purposes. They take tiny bits of it, and it's very good, gets you high. And he had his 2-year supply of arsenic, which was about a lethal dose for about 10 people. Maharaji says, where's your arsenic? Oh, Maharaji, I don't have any arsenic. Give me your arsenic. And he took the whole thing and he ate it. And everybody started to cry and nothing happens. So this time he said, well, it made me crazy. And I said, sure, probably. And he said, how long will it take? And I said, about an hour. And he called an old man over with a watch and he held the man when he was looking at the watch, And it was a whole Marx Brothers routine. And at one point he went under his blanket and he came up looking totally insane. He came out. He was just like incredibly crazy looking. And he sucked me in again, see, and I thought, oh God, what have I done? He didn't take it last time, and he knows I knew that because he's a mind reader. He's a good mind reader, so he's figuring he better do it this time, and he didn't know what he was getting in for, and he's gone crazy, and I'm going to have all this in my head. I've made this wonderful old man insane, and, he was just playing with me all the time, At the end of an hour, he looks at the watch, he points to the watch, he looks at me, he says, well, what do you think? I said, well, I guess it's not going to work. He says, you got anything stronger? I said, no, Maharaji. He said, these were known about long ago in the Kulu Valley. But he said, most of that knowledge about these has been lost now. They don't know anything about this anymore. Yogis don't know about it. Most yogis would be afraid to take this, he said. And then he gave me a long list of all the yogis who'd be afraid to take it. And if you notice in Raja Yoga, in Patanjali's Ashtanga Yoga, there is reference to the use of these kinds of chemicals for altering consciousness. Then Maharaji says, but it's not the ultimate samadhi. Later on, we asked him, Maharaji, is it all right to use chemicals? Should we? Or what should we do about it? He said, it could be useful. He said, if you were to take it in a cool place, not in a hot climate, in a cool place, and your mind was feeling much peace, and you were alone, and you would turn towards God, he said, it would allow you to come into the room and pranam. You could pranam to Christ, meaning you could come in and have darshan of the Spirit, come into the presence of the Spirit. He said, you could only stay 2 hours and then you'd have to leave again. He said, it would be better to become Christ than to just pranam to him. But that medicine won't do that for you. But he said, it will strengthen your faith, because even to visit a holy man for a few hours strengthens faith. But he said, love is a much more powerful medicine than LSD. Much more powerful medicine. Now, as you know, Gordon Wasson, for example, Gordon Wasson was a mycologist. He married a Russian mushroom collector. He was the vice president of the Morgan Guarantee Trust Company in New York, and then he got interested in the mushrooms, which in Mexico are known as Tiahuanaco, the flesh of the gods, and they are the psilocybe mushroom and a few other varieties that bring about altered consciousness. And he retired as vice president of the Morgan Guarantee Trust, and he went around the world studying these mushrooms and the mushroom stones, and he has found mushroom stones, these stones that are shaped as mushrooms, connected with religions, very, very ancient religions throughout the world. And the present thesis, which is a very far-out thesis, is that the original mystics were mushroom eaters from the mountains in the north and came down into the Indus Valley where they couldn't grow the mushrooms, and all of pranayama and hatha yoga and raja yoga were all developed in order to create the same states that the mushrooms had originally created for these tribes. Right? Now that's all speculation on history. But I don't think there's any doubt now that the soma or the medicines that were taken in the Eleusinian rites among the Greeks and so on were all part of ways of altering consciousness through better living through chemistry. The predicament is that we now face is that most of these substances are illegal, and therefore when you work with them, you are not fulfilling Maharaji's criterion of feeling total peace, because there is a paranoia. That means that there's a certain little part of your consciousness that has to be held down to watch out for the fuzz, if you will, if you don't mind my putting it in the vernacular. Like, I've had sessions where I've just had somebody on duty, not that I saw, but somebody that was just available for me outside, but not somebody I had to interact with in consciousness, just to keep the scene on the physical plane cool so I could do my inner work. I think that I've been fulfilling Maharaji's criterion since he told me that in 1970, when I'm in a cool place feeling much peace and my mind is turned towards God and I'm alone. And I have taken acid once a year since then in order to understand what's happening to me and in order to explore, because it does show me places that I'm still clinging. And the first time I took it in 71, I took it in the Mid-America Motel in Salina, Kansas. I was feeling much peace, I was alone, my mind was turned towards God. And in that session, I had the darshan of Maharaji. He came to me at the motel, and he then manifested in the exact way that the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is written. So that I was up against the wall in total panic, because the room was filled with the entire universe, and Maharaji kept turning into all these other beings and absorbing. He was sitting on the bed laughing, and all this stuff was going in and out of him, right? And that happened to me in relation to this thing. It's very interesting, because what I've said the Gita talks about is that you come to Brahman and then you know the Purushatma. And before that vision occurred, I had panicked. I started the session with a total grade B melodrama panic, a bad trip it's called. And I was about to run naked out of the motel room to the manager and say, "You've got to help me, I'm going to die." And then I saw myself running to the manager, and I saw the manager's mind, and I saw what I looked like to the manager's mind. This middle-aged, bald, naked man ran out of room 125 and said, "I'm going to die." And then I thought of the police and the psychiatrist and the tranquilizer, and I thought, no, there must be a better way to die than that. So I looked around inside the room for a way to die other than that. And then everything I thought up, I thought, is there a way I can avoid dying? And there wasn't any way I could avoid dying. Some of the ways I thought of dying would take 40 years, but still I would die, see? And I began to realize that it was inevitable that as long as I thought I was anybody, I was going to die. And I finally gave up, and I said to Maharaji, "Please let me die. I want to die." And I lay down in front of the television set, which had Maharaji's picture right in the middle of it, with the images coming out from his head. And I decided I posed myself to die, figuring the next day the police photographers will come in, and this will be like Crap's last tape. I hope they take a picture of the final scene of the television and Maharaji, because this is my mid-America trip. When I said, "I want to die," then what happened was there was a blank space, and then the next thought that occurred after that interstice between mind moments was, "Wow, you can be anything you want to be this time then." And I started to reincarnate again. That is, my karma made it all only momentary before I reasserted it. But when I came back, if you will, in a freer way than before. And it was only out of that space of freedom that I had this vision. Now, my statement to people about psychedelics, since I've raised the topic, I must say this, is that the strategy we have recommended to the government for a number of years, and we continue to recommend, is that the reasonable thing to do about things that alter human consciousness is to educate people, not police them. And you can license them and educate them. You don't prohibit stuff. and you respect other beings' rights to alter their own consciousness. And I respect your rights to hear all this stuff. And I would never, ever tell anybody to alter their consciousness this way or that. I don't tell people to meditate unless they ask me, should I do this? And then I say, study and understand it, and then I will tell you something. That's a different place. But I don't say everybody should take acid or turn on with grass or anything. The predicament is that various psychedelics are different strengths. And some are so mild, for example, most marijuana, that all it does is exacerbate the paranoia you're already in. So you just get more paranoid than you were before. It doesn't override your personality. The stronger psychedelics like mescaline, psilocybin, LSD, things like that, tend to override your existing habit patterns. And most people that are not prepared and don't have a deep enough gyan or understanding of what they're doing, they freak when their entire structure of existence starts to fall away. You have very good music or something that you can surrender into that's familiar and comfortable. And always to do it in a place where you're not going to be disturbed and where there's minimum paranoia. The other place that's freaky for people about psychedelics is the reentry, when they come back and they see what a schlock scene they're coming back into. And usually that merely motivates them to start to clean up their game. And that's just part of the process of seeing the horror that we have created out of our ignorance. And you just get on with it and you start to live with that. My feeling is that each person should listen in their own heart. There is no reason in this day and age why you have to bomb yourself out to awaken. Because the fact that you've even gotten a Naropa means you already know what you need to know. And once you've had the darshan of Christ, and once the faith is strong enough to have gotten you to come to Naropa, you don't have to keep shooting up to get the faith stronger. Then at some point your faith is strong enough so you just get on with it. So that I would say that I don't really take psychedelics each year out of any, oh my God, here's it. In 3 more months I can do it again. It's not that so much as the fact that my particular dharma is as somebody who represents the history of the psychedelic movement in America and the spiritual scene, and I'm not busy not doing anything, right? I'm not somebody who's got a thing. I may never take psychedelics again, and I may take them tomorrow.